All right, let's go to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2, it's been a few weeks, but we just moved over into this chapter. This is, of course, not a real long work of Peter, but he does hit some pretty heavy things, and he doesn't pull punches on these things. One of the issues that have come up in his letters, as in Paul's, is this problem with false doctrine, false teachers rising up among the people. And so when you go to verse 1, it says, "But false prophets also rose among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you." And so Peter's, you know, telling them straight out, these false teachers are coming. You just need to be aware that this is going to happen, and you need to be on guard for it. He says, he goes on, "who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the master who bought them, bringing upon themselves swift destruction." That's a pretty audacious statement. That these individuals, whoever these false teachers are, they're going to go so far as denying Jesus. That's the master, right, who bought them. And so whatever doctrine they're teaching, they're speaking blasphemy against him. And so he says that will bring swift destruction upon themselves. Now, what will that be? Well, it's going to be different depending on how God deals with each individual. But ultimately, what's the destruction that they're bringing upon themselves? Who? What?
Hell.
Yeah, eternal judgment, right? What are you saying?
The eternal punishment.
Mm-hmm.
The second death.
Yeah. No, you're right. And so he says they're going to come, know that. He says they're going to go so far as denying the master in some way. I don't know. He doesn't explain what that really is. But in some way, they're going to deny the master who bought them. He says, verse 2, this is where we left off. "And many will follow their sensuality, and because of the way of truth will be the way of truth will be blasphemed." So first, there's kind of a two-part phrase there. He says, first, where is the motivation coming from for what they're doing? Well, yeah, all sin is selfishness, but he says the word sensuality. What is sensuality? What's that?
I'm tied to the world. That's the first yawn, I guess. The passions of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very fleshly idea here, that they are looking for some kind of physical pleasure in this world, right? That could be any number of things. Sexual pleasure, it could also be other things that give them a sense of a pleasure in this world. And so he says they're going to follow after what? Their passions, their physical passions, and that's going to come in conflict with what? Absolutely, and so that will get them in contradiction with the way of truth. So then what do they end up doing? Blaspheming the truth. Now, this may be a reference to, again, I know you've heard this a few times, the Gnostic idea that will develop in the second century, where the Gnostics... Do you all remember hearing about the Epicureans and Stoics? Anybody tell me what the Epicureans and Stoics, what was their basic belief pattern? What was at the foundation of what they believed, the Epicureans?
That all physical matter was evil.
Okay. Help her out. Somebody help her out. What are the Epicureans? Some of y'all studied this. What do the Epicureans believe? All right. You're going to leave it all on me, huh? All right. So the Epicureans it was a way of thinking toward the body that it was evil and corrupted. And so therefore, because the flesh is evil and corrupted, it doesn't really matter what you do. So just go live it up. They tried to make this delineation between the flesh and the spirit, and to separate those two, and that the spirit could travel its own road and the flesh could travel its own road, and they don't have to intersect. So they were trying to eliminate the tie between the two, and that what we do physically has an effect on us spiritually, right? That's what sin is. We sin in the flesh, which causes what to our spirit? Death. And so so that idea of the Epicureans. Now, the Stoics were kind of different. They had a similar belief in the flesh, but they had developed this consciousness of, since the flesh is evil, we need to abstain anything of the flesh. So to get rid of all fleshly desire and not give in to the flesh. So very different. Although they start in a similar place, they end in a very different. Well, that thought of the Epicureans is similar to those of the Gnostics, who again, tried to separate the two doctrinal ideas. And the Gnostics, as time would come, they would even go as far as to say, Jesus never really came in the flesh because he's deity and because flesh is wicked. Does that sound like a common doctrine of today? Anybody know? Anybody want to take a shot in the dark? This idea of the wickedness of the flesh, that we are by nature sinful creatures. Calvinism, that's one. What's the other one? Come on. Catholicism. They both teach that similar idea.
What's the other one?
That by nature, our flesh is wicked, which is Calvinism teaches that, and so does Catholicism. Well, that doctrine is not new to those two groups. This has roots way back to the first century and second century with the Gnostics. And so they believed that the flesh and the spirit were detached from one another. And so what you do physically doesn't really matter spiritually. And so, again, if I go back here, and that's blasphemy, right? That's against what God has told us is true. And so they live to their sensuality. They live toward their passions. So go live life up, because it didn't really affect your spirit. And yeah. Yeah. So you see the roots of that all throughout. Well, not all throughout, but in the New Testament text, where different Bible writers are writing toward these ideas that are beginning to develop. Well, Peter, if this is what Peter's talking about, which would make sense, this Peter can see it as early as the 50s and early 60s. So, so he goes on to say, verse 3, and in their greed and their desire for you know, sensuality and their greed of the flesh, they will exploit you with false words. Their condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. So God, it's not as though God is not aware of what's going on. And that's why he's warning the people of Peter's day. Then as we get into verses 4 through about verse 9, Peter's going to bring up some interesting, and he's going to leave us wanting for more information that he's not going to give us. But he's going to bring up some examples of when God brought judgment. So, what's the first group he brings up as an example of God's judgment? So he says, verse 4, "For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness, to be kept until the judgment." Let me go ahead. I'm just going to read it all, and then we'll talk about each example. "If he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of truth, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. If by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what was going to happen to the ungodly. And if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual, notice that term again, sensual conduct of the wicked. For as the righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous from, under punishment until the day of judgment, especially those who indulge in the lust of defiling passion and despise authority. Bold and willful, they do not tremble as they blaspheme the glorious ones. We'll stop there, and we'll get to the next section in a minute. But let's just note some of the things here. So what are the examples he gives us? Well, first, he gives us angels. What's the second one? Noah. What's the third one? Sodom and Gomorrah. So he gives us three examples. Now, just stepping back from this for a minute, bringing up those three examples are very much Old Testament, right? Which may indicate that who Peter's writing to must have been a Christian audience that had a Jewish background, who would have been very familiar with the details of these narratives. That's a guess. But again, it lends proof to the idea that Peter's main audience were Jews, Jewish Christians. So he brings up angels who sinned. Well, who are these angels? Well, there's honestly not a lot of information. I'll give you a couple references to what it might be. Let me give you those real quick. First one is in Jude. So go over to the little book of Jude. Jude only has one chapter, verse 6. Jude verse 6 says something very similar to what you see here in Peter's writing. Again, discussing sin. It's an interesting connection between Jude and Peter. Who is Jude, by the way? Okay, James' brother. I thought you'd go to the other brother first. Jesus' brother. This is one of Jesus' brothers. And we know from the book of Acts that James and Peter had a close relationship. It may be indicative that Jude and Peter would have had a close relationship as well. Although Jude's mentioned a lot less as one of the brothers, or comes up less often in the New Testament text. But Jude writes in somewhat a familiar way to Peter. So let's go to Jude 1:6. It says, "And the angels who did not sin," I'm sorry, let me reread that, "who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains," that's similar language to 2 Peter, "he has kept in eternal chains, under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day." Very similar language in regard to their punishment, right? That both are kept under chains, right? They're being held captive by God to await what? Judgment day. The one piece of, if this is the same angels, and I'm assuming that, if these are the same group of angels, both in 2 Peter and Jude, then Jude gives us a little more information. That so where Peter just says they sinned, Jude says, what was their particular sin? They left their proper position, right, or dwelling place, and they did something they shouldn't have. What was that? We have no idea, right? It doesn't give us any more than that. So we know they were given a direction. They were supposed to be somewhere. They left that and did this other thing. Okay? What was that? Don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it does let us know that angels can sin, right? They have freedom of choice, like we. Now, to what degree, we can discuss all that, but they do have the ability to choose to violate God's will. They've sinned, okay? So let me give you one more place where we may have a connection. Again, we're making some subjective judgment call here. But if you go over to Matthew 25, 41. Matthew 25, 41. Somebody read that real nice and loud. Give my voice a break for a second. Be like last week, I'm going to have to call people out, aren't I, man?
We're just slow patients.
And he will also say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, to an everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels.
All right, so Matthew 25 is judgment day. You're separating the sheep, those on the right from those on the left. Right, those on the right are the righteous. Those on the left are the wicked, right? And he's just spelling out what their punishment's going to be. What's their punishment?
Everlasting destruction in hell.
Absolutely. Now, he clues us into something kind of interesting here. Hell was not created for their punishment. Hell was actually created, or was going to be created, for whose punishment? The intention of hell is who? The devil and his angels. Now, is this the same angels? Again, making a little bit of a subjective judgment call. That would make sense, but it doesn't necessarily have to make sense. These don't have to be the same angels. But you do see these three different occasions where you have a group of angels discussed who sinned and are awaiting judgment. So these angels in 25, Matthew 25, in Jude 6, and then in 2 Peter, all are awaiting God's judgment, where they'll be sent into eternal destruction. So, if we go back to 2 Peter, there's nothing that I'm aware of. Somebody has more information on it, I'd love to hear it. Now, we have more information on Satan. We could go down that route. I don't have time to do that today. But just the angels themselves, we don't know what exactly that is. But we do know currently, they have been committed to chains until when? We know that without a doubt. He says they're under chains until when? Judgment day. So they're being held by God until judgment day. All right. Go ahead.
It seems interesting. It's part of the King James. It says
we're getting ready to go there, yeah. But go ahead and say what you want to say.
Chained into Tars, the place that is all dead soul.
Yes.
As a paradise on one side of the
punishment. Yeah. So let's talk about Tartarus for a minute. So the word hell there, to the best of my knowledge, is not the best translation. This is not hell, eternal hell. That's not where they're being kept. It's a word used one time. Peter's it. He uses it right here, and that's it. He uses the word Tartarus. It's an interesting term, not real common, but Tartarus in the Greek world was a reference that they would use in, now think about outside of Christianity. This is in the Greek world. They would use Tartarus in the way they talked about where evil spirits would go when they were punished. And so it seems as though Peter has went over, pulled that term over, and said, I'm going to use it here to describe the punishment of the wicked. So, why is it not hell?
If
what?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's right, and because hell is the judgment after judgment day. That's the place of judgment after judgment day. Prior to it, it is Hades in the Hadean realm, and so the way he's using Tartarus here is most likely, in my mind, it is a reference to the place of torment in Hades. So.
Same.
Yes, I believe it. And subjective opinion here, right? I can't, there's not a lot of Bible support or necessarily, well, there's just not a lot written about it, but my belief is it's the same place where those who are human beings who have now died and their spirit is left, it's the same place they're being held. The way of judgment. So good comment. And you can go and study it, you might come up with a totally different opinion. So it's just an unusual word, and Peter just brings it out here, which is interesting. I don't know why the Holy Spirit chose to do that, but that's what he does. No yawning. Not over yet. I'm just kidding. So the first example are these angels who sinned. Again, the sin is not described by Peter, but they're being held, kept under guard or in punishment until judgment day. All right, that's the first example. The second example he gives is Noah. And we won't spend a lot of time on this, but you'll remember Noah was the one in Genesis 6:8 that found grace in the eyes of the Lord in the midst of a very wicked generation. And of course, it was Noah along with his family that were saved in the ark, where eight souls were saved by water, 1 Peter chapter 3 describes. It's interesting, Peter brings up Noah in both his letters as an example of faithfulness, but also an example of what? God's judgment and God's salvation. So Noah was the second example. The third example is the example of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, if you were going to go look at this, where would you go?
Genesis
what? What'd you say? 19. Very good job. Genesis 19, you'll read about the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. What was their great sin? All right. You can go back to Genesis 19 and read about it. You can also go over to Jude. Again, let's go back to Jude. A lot of similarities between Jude and 2 Peter. Jude gives us a little bit on this. Let me give you the verse here. I lost my verse. Okay, 7. Yes, thank you. So he's going to follow up his statement about the angels, and he, like Peter, goes right into talking about Sodom and Gomorrah. And so he says in verse 7, Jude 1:7, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, so all that area, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. All right, so what was the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah? Homosexuality is one of their sins. It's not, do you think that's their only sin? That was not their only sin. This word unnatural is a fascinating kind of term. I'm trying to think of how to say this. It's not really deep enough to understanding in our language just to call it unnatural. It was a deep-rooted evil. What they were doing. Now, they, like any people, had other sins and they had other wickedness. But God has a limit, doesn't he? Whatever that is, and God gets to determine what that limit is when God says, that's enough, I can't stand it any longer. Genesis 6, God got to a point, he said, I can't stand it anymore. Genesis 19, God said, I can't stand it anymore. In the book of Jonah, God said, I can't stand it anymore with Nineveh. I've reached my limit. Now, Nineveh repented, the others did not. Hold on just a second, Roger, and I'll come back to you. But But the sin, I know some have tried to claim that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was not necessarily homosexuality, but was the forced sexual behavior that they were trying to force themselves. That's not the way the text dispels what they are. Again, unnatural. You go to Romans chapter 1, Paul gets into a good discussion about how sin, all sin is wickedness. All sin is a violation of God's will, but not all sin is the same. There are sins we commit that are so wicked, they're against nature. They're against the natural order of things. And homosexuality is one of those sins. Go ahead, Roger. Well, but we don't know they necessarily had rape. They may have been intending to do that. We read into that a little bit about what's going on there with them going to the angels. But their sin, their wickedness is more, and don't get me wrong, that violation of rape and stuff is very wicked. But the homosexuality adds a layer to this that elevates the wickedness in its own way. Yes, that's the point. Right? It doesn't matter whether they did it willingly or I don't want to get any further into that, but y'all get my point. It's a wickedness of its own. And so he says back, well, in Jude 1:7, he says, they serve as a what? An example of ungodliness. They do, but they also serve as another kind of example. Notice the end of that verse. They serve as an example of judgment, God's judgment on wickedness. And they are a reminder to us, living today, of what happens to those who have unrepentant wickedness, who refuse to repent, refuse to give up their evil, and how God will punish them. If I go back to 2 Peter, he says that God did what? He turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes. They remain as an example to us. I mean, the salt sea is the salt sea. Why? Because of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, it wasn't the salt sea until God brought down his judgment on them. And so they remain as an example of us of God's severe judgment. All right. Then I'm going to close out here, but I at least want to get through 9 if I can. But then he brings up Lot. Lot's an interesting individual, isn't he? He's a tragic individual in some ways. But as described by Peter, he's also a what? What was he called here?
Righteous.
And he was a righteous man who was greatly disturbed or upset about what he saw going on around him. That's true. But it seems to be the reason Peter's bringing him up here is to remind us just because we live in a wicked culture does not mean we have to be wicked. We can stand up against that. We don't have to go along with wickedness just because we feel pressure to, even very heavy pressure. You think he felt pressure to go along with it? I'm sure he did. But he refused. He said he was vexed day to day. However, verse 8, he was a righteous man who lived among them day after day. He was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds, over what he saw and heard. So that's number one. We don't have to go along with wickedness just because that's what they're doing. Number two, what do we need to wait on? What does he say? He says, verse 9, the Lord knows how to what? Rescue. Rescue the godly from those trials. Now, he had to wait a little while, didn't he? But God eventually rescued him. He picked their family out of all the families of Sodom and Gomorrah. God knew how to pick that one family. He knew that one family was the one, had the patriarch who was trying to live a righteous life. And God went down and brought him out, but destroyed all of those wicked people. Same thing with Noah, right? Noah stands out as a man who was rescued by God in a very wicked time. He notes a couple of things here. I'll real quickly say this, verse 10. He notes something, some of the characteristics about the wickedness of the cultures that Noah and Lot lived in. He says that they indulge in the lust of defiling passions. That's going back to their sexual sinfulness. But not only do that, but they do what? They despise authority. Why is that important to note here? What's the key to despising authority? Despising authority is the gateway to a lot of sinful behavior. Why so? Why would I make that statement? What now? Okay. I like where you're going there. Somebody add to that there. She's headed down. She's barking up the right tree there. What's that now? Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah, it's, and why do we despise any authority in our lives? Because we don't want to be told what to do when we want to do it. If I can just get rid of the authority, then I can do whatever I want. I'm my own God, right? A fool is in his heart, there is no God. Why is a fool saying in his heart, there is no God? They don't want God. Romans chapter 1, although they knew God, they did what? Refused to acknowledge him. They despised authority. They were bold and willful. They did not tremble. Even, what did James say? Even the demons believe and tremble. All right? But they had gotten to a point where they didn't tremble any longer. They felt no shame as they blasphemed the glorious one. We'll stop right there. I know I'm out of time. We'll come back to verse 11. Got to get through this. But we'll keep talking about what's going on here with some of these wicked false teachers. Again, what is that section all about? What's Peter trying to remind us of? God will judge false prophets. And God knows how to rescue the just. So those two ideas. When we come back next week, we'll go on in verse 11 to discuss some more about this judgment of God and where these false teachers are leading the people. One last comment. What? Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. All right. Thanks, guys. We'll close out there, and we'll come back to verse 11 in a couple of weeks. Before we close out, do I have anybody who was not able to partake of the Lord's Supper this morning? Miss Betty? You mind? All right. So we're going to close out with a prayer, and then we'll dismiss.